And it is today's Topical Currents, 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman is off today. Well, network and local news programs of yesteryear were intended for a wide audience spectrum. Think of the likes of Ed Murrow, Walter Cronkite, David Brinkley, and colleagues. But the landscape has greatly changed with cable TV, blogs, and social media. Joining me now is Tampa Bay Times TV and media critic Eric Deggans. He's written Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Welcome to you, Eric Deggans. You're joining us from Tampa.
Joining you actually from St. Petersburg.
From
the offices of the Tampa Bay Times.
So this race baiter business with you started with criticism and bantering by Bill O'Reilly on Fox. Fill us in on that.
Sure. Bill O'Reilly does these commentaries that kick off his show called the Talking Points Memo. And he did one where he talked about how he felt that white people couldn't talk to black people about race anymore because it was too dangerous. It was too easy for white people to make a mistake or slip or be misconstrued and be called a racist. And then he went on to sort of list all of these people and institutions that he felt had sort of unjustly alleged racism against white people. And he named Jesse Jackson, and he named the liberal watchdog group Media Matters, and he named me. And he never really said why I landed on that list, although I've written pieces that are critical of him in the past, and we've been back and forth over them. I serve... excuse me, as chairman of the Media Monitoring Committee for the National Association of Black Journalists. So there's a group of us inside this group, the NABJ, that keeps an eye on how people of color are covered in the news media and try to recommend ways to improve that. And we also advise the board of the group on who to acknowledge for best practices and who to criticize for their thumbs down award every year. So he never really explained, other than citing my chairmanship of this group, as for any reason why I would be designated, in his words, as the biggest race baiter in America. And so I used to tell friends this story. You know, of course, I wrote a piece where I said being called a race baiter by Bill O'Reilly is actually a good thing. And then my friends kept saying, you know, you tell this story all the time, but it seems like there's a book in the idea that when you try to talk about race and you try to talk about stereotyping in media and you try to get at what's happening on cable TV news and talk radio and the internet, often people turn around and call you the race baiter for bringing it up in the first place. And I said, you know what, that's a great idea. So I went off and I spent a year sort of developing a proposal where I pulled together almost more than 10 years of writing about race and media and society into a coherent vision. And then I spent another 4 months or so writing the book after I got a contract.
Now, the history of the term race baiting really goes back to the 1920s, I believe, that I read in your book. And it was originally intended to be that it was white people, white politicians, using race to divide the electorate.
Yeah, I had a friend who is an expert in language at the University of South Florida to look into this for me, and that some of the earliest mentions he could find of that term, race baiter, referred to white politicians who were using fears of integration and fears of runaway runaway problems with people of color as a way to build their own political power. And for many years, that was how the term was most often used. You might refer to somebody like Bull Connor or somebody like George Wallace, who built his political power in the 50s and 60s as an ardent opponent of integration. But in more recent times, that term has been used, again, I think, to try and silence people who want to talk about instances where stereotyping and prejudice surface in media and are used as components of a money-making strategy for some media outlets. And when you try to call attention to that, when you say, hey, you know, Don Imus has a 20-year history of using racism and prejudice and jokes about people of color to fuel his radio show and cable TV show, people will turn around and say, well, you know, you're always talking about race, or, you know, you're too sensitive. You know, you're the one with the problem. And so often you just have to sort of focus through that, focus on the facts, focus on what you can see happening right in front of your face, and encourage people to understand that talking about race does not make you racist, and talking about these issues of prejudice and stereotyping in media is not racist, even if occasionally you're not right.
Well, give us your view, Eric Deggans, about when Al Sharpton was hosting on MSNBC and covering the Trayvon Martin case, while at the same time he was had a very high-profile advocacy thing going on and rallies. He was rallying and calling for the arrest of George Zimmerman while he was being an MSNBC, quote, host.
Right. That's an interesting case that I talk about in the first chapter of the book. And you know, in that way, I wanted to make sure that the book was not just this polemic against the conservative media, although I think conservative media has more effectively and more aggressively used some of these tactics that I talk about. So Al Sharpton, when the Trayvon Martin situation happened, and for the few of your reader, of your listeners who may not be totally up to speed, you know, a teenage black boy was killed while walking back to a residence that he was hanging out with his father in Sanford, Florida. The shooter who killed him, George Zimmerman, was not initially arrested by police, and the family suspected that one reason he wasn't arrested was because he had killed a black boy in a neighborhood where they claimed to have had problems with crime committed by young black men. So eventually, Al Sharpton stepped in to become a public spokesman for the family for a time, as they tried to press the local and regional and state officials to prosecute George Zimmerman. So you had this unusual circumstance where you had a man who was an anchor on MSNBC, a cable news channel, had a 6 p.m. show, was also serving as the spokesman for a family at the center of the, at the time, was the number two most covered story in the country. And I talk in the book about how he held a rally in Sanford, Florida on March 22nd of last year, where he started the rally and talked about how Zimmerman needed to be arrested, and collected money for the family, and then took a break at 6 p.m., brought Trayvon Martin's family, parents, onto his MSNBC show, Politics Nation, and interviewed them. And then when his show was over, he went right back to leading the rally and calling for George Zimmerman's arrest. And that's something that we really haven't seen before. I mean, we've seen people who are opinionated host shows in cable television, and of course, the most popular show anchors on cable television news are opinionated, but we haven't seen somebody who is an active participant in a news story also be an anchor at a cable TV news channel. And the president of MSNBC, Phil Griffin, when I asked him about some of these situations, I didn't get to ask him necessarily directly about Al Sharpton at that point, but when I have asked him about this in the past, his response has always been that cable TV has changed, and that we should not expect the most popular personalities on cable, quote unquote, news channels to actually be journalists or be people who are objective in the traditional way that we consider news personalities to be.
Touch on the stridency of today's media landscape, particularly cable TV, and that they have to play for the demographics of their consumers, be it Fox, CNN, MSNBC, and I guess to some extent even public radio has a demographic that they play to.
Or
that
public radio to. Most definitely has a demographic. It's a college-educated, middle-class, generally white person. But, yeah, sure. And I think if you look at the cable channels, again, because cable channels are niche products, and they really try to find sort of the biggest niche of viewers to get to watch what they're doing, you can look at what they do, and you can guess what their target audience is. So MSNBC recently had a story about its success in targeting black viewers, reported by, I think, the Associated Press. And they're very proud of the fact that they're the most watched cable channel amongst black viewers of and viewers of color on cable television. And one reason they are is because they have more high-profile anchors of color on that channel than anyone else. And they were very aggressive about covering issues such as the Trayvon Martin situation from the viewpoint of the Trayvon Martin's parents, as opposed to the white power structure that they were challenging. By contrast, Fox News Channel seems to very specifically target middle-aged white males. And you can tell that from the fact that their most popular news anchors are either middle-aged white males or very attractive younger white women. And you can tell that also by the way that they choose the issues that they're going to talk about. In my third chapter of the book, which is called Fox News Channel's Focus on Scary Black People Leaves Race Relations as Collateral Damage, I talk a little bit about how Fox News Channel tries to embody and echo a lot of the fears about people of color and particularly African Americans that their target audience already has. So there was a poll that the Brookings Institution did a while ago noting that there's a healthy percentage of people who think that we've reached a point where everything is equal and there's just as much of a chance that white people might be discriminated against because of their race as there is that people of color would be discriminated against. I think it was under 50%, but over 40%. I can't remember the exact number, but it's in the book. Now, if you look at Fox News viewers, that percentage jumps to 70%. And if you look at people of color, Hispanics and African Americans, especially, that number drops down closer to 30%. So you can see that there's a real difference in how the target audience views the possibility that institutional racism might affect people, or that affirmative action is necessary, or that there's any chance that police in a neighborhood in a community like Sanford might discriminate against a family of color to favor a person who was a volunteer neighborhood watch captain in their community and who they kind of knew. So when you understand what the target audience is and how that channel makes money, that channel makes money by embodying the worldview of the people who watch it. So of course, Fox News Channel might be a little less sensitive to issues of prejudice and stereotyping involving people of color than MSNBC might be.
We're speaking with Tampa Bay Times TV and media critic Eric Deggans. He's the author of Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. We're going to take a short break on our program. We'll be back with more. And we're back with Eric Deggans of the Tampa Bay Times. We're talking about his book, Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. And Eric Deggans will be coming to Coral Gables to Books and Books. That's tonight at 8 p.m. That's the Coral Gables store. That's on Aragon Avenue in Coral Gables at 8 o'clock. And he's joining us right now from St. Pete, so he's going to have a pretty quick car ride.
Yeah, I'm counting on the angels to help me to keep the interstate clear.
Well, don't get caught up with the FHP now.
No, not at all. I will be observing the speed limits and crossing my fingers a lot.
Eric Deggans, you mentioned in our first segment your affiliation with the Black Journalist Association of some kind. So I guess we should mention that you are an African American.
I am African American, and it's the National Association of Black Journalists. Yes.
Okay. Tell me more about the demographics that cable TV finds that they need to maintain. Is it also reflecting in the various advertising?
Oh, sure. Well, it's all about advertising in the end, because that's how cable channels or most media outlets convert their audience into money. What you're trying to do is draw the kind of audience that advertisers want to pay money to access. And as you said in the introduction to our talk, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, TV networks drew the biggest audience possible. Their target audience was kind of generally viewers aged 25 to 54, but the way they drew those numbers was that they tried to find shows that had the broadest appeal possible, and they tried to draw huge amounts of people, and then they would sell access to those people to advertisers. Now we've reached a point where those kind of mass audiences are just not possible anymore. Only the most popular football games get close to that level of really broad audience. So now cable channels make money by targeting very specific audiences. So AMC, for example, the channel that has Walking Dead and Mad Men and Breaking Bad, their audience is more upscale, their audience is more male, their audience is younger than 25 to 54. Obviously, you look at Black Entertainment Television or TV1, channels that target a black audience, their demographic would be different. So that also happens with cable news channels. Now, you don't care so much if an entertainment channel develops programming that targets a specific audience. You watch Comedy Central, for example, and it is obvious that that channel is focused to appeal to young white males. Show after show after show that appeals to their culture stars that kind of person very often.
So it's cars and beers and shaving.
No, it's irreverent humor. It's in your face humor.
I mean the advertising.
The advertising. I mean advertisers love young white males anyway. They wouldn't put the white part in there, but they would certainly say that young audiences age 18 to 49 and 18 to 34 are their target audiences. So that's McDonald's, that's Nike, that's movies, because young people are thought to go to movies much more often. I think the older audience is given short shrift, frankly, because I think when you get older, you tend to consume things that cost more. You're buying a car, you're buying a house, you're spending money on vacations. You are consuming as much or more as somebody who's 17, 18, 19, or 20, but still and yet, a huge swath of television is focused on trying to attract people who are essentially in their early 30s.
I suppose the conventional wisdom is that older audience members aren't as malleable to advertising changes. I'm going to probably use the same toothpaste and use the same products over and over again now that I'm in the older demographic.
Yeah, I guess that is the conventional wisdom. I don't know that that's true. I know just as many older people who are willing to switch brands if it's actually a good brand. And certainly you can sell to them. And certainly you're looking for great deals on airline flights. You're looking for great deals on trips. You're looking to, when you're going to change your car, you're looking for a great deal on that. If somebody comes to you with a great deal, you're going to listen to it. I think that kind of conventional wisdom is created because the people who tend to make the decisions about buying ads are also in their early to mid-30s. And so they've come up with some rationales to justify their purchasing decisions that I don't necessarily know are completely true. And they wind up, what ends up happening on television is very curious. The people who use television the most are often valued the least. So older people who watch television more than younger people, women who watch television more than men, people of color who watch television more than white people, they are all valued less because they're viewed as easier to get viewers, right? So imagine if you had a restaurant where the person who comes in and eats every day and spends a fair amount of money and tips really well, and you say to them, hey, welcome, Tom, we're going to put you right next to the bathroom. And somebody who comes in who's not going to buy that much, probably doesn't tip that much, and won't come back again, gets the best seat in the house. But that's how television operates often. That's starting to change a little bit, particularly with the way that television delivery systems are changing. But right now, that focus on niche viewers means that many media outlets are being forced to concentrate on the most profitable niche of viewers. And in the news area where consumers tend to be older, that is more middle-aged, and that is white, and that is male. And so you do find in talk radio, outside of public radio, of course, and on cable TV news, you find a lot of corners of media that are aimed specifically at that demographic. And again, that's not so much a problem as long as you're not demonizing groups that don't fit that category in order to make the people you're trying to attract feel more at home.
Sometimes I get emails here from the programming that we do, and also, I guess, just public radio in general, of conservatives who are very much disturbed about that they're portrayed by liberals as radical, greedy, and narrow-minded, and with a very wide brush.
Well, all I can say is look at some of the most listened to conservative radio talk show hosts and look at what their message is. You know, Rush Limbaugh is the leading radio commentary. He's the leading radio talk show host in America. He's also the leading conservative talk show host in America. And I have a whole chapter in the book devoted to how talk radio has been taken over by these angry white men, and in some ways has really harmed the form of talk radio in general. There are people who were involved in creating talk radio as we know it now in the 70s and 80s, who feel that it's become too insular, that it's become too hateful, that it's become too punitive. There was a time when you listened to Rush Limbaugh and he made fun of his political opponents. And he talked about how being conservative was fun. It was desirable because it was fun. Now you listen to Rush Limbaugh and you know, he goes after someone like Sandra Fluck, who really is not a particularly notable, was not a particularly notable person until he put her in his crosshairs, and just was relentlessly sort of slagging her off, insulting her, saying all these things about her that he couldn't possibly have any evidence for, simply based on the fact that she gave some testimony during a congressional hearing. And it damaged his show tremendously. And there are radio chains like Cumulus that have said publicly that they have lost millions of dollars because Rush Limbaugh seemed to be this hateful person who was targeting essentially a private person who didn't deserve, a college student who didn't deserve that kind of vitriol. So you look at Rush Limbaugh, you look at Glenn Beck, you look at Sean Hannity, you look at Michael Savage. You know, I have just named the top four talk show hosts.
I think Savage is the most virulent.
In news and information, and every one of them is incredibly critical, incredibly harsh, and has presented material on their show that's unfair and untrue about people of color. Glenn Beck called the president a racist. Sean Hannity has had these people from Breitbart.com come on and make allegations about the President Obama being associated with quote-unquote radicals in Harvard when he was a student there. And, you know, all of these things that just seem to be, in the best light, they are exaggerations of the truth. And they're doing that in part because they know what their audience is, and they're desperately trying to attract them.
We're speaking with Eric Deggans. He's the Tampa Bay Times media critic. We're talking about his book, Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Let's take a short break. We'll be back with more. And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We rejoin with Eric Deggans. He's joining us from St. Pete. And once again, he'll be appearing at Books and Books in Coral Gables. That's, tonight at 8 p.m. Eric, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
Sure. The website is my name, www.ericdeggans, ericdeggans.com.
Tell me about... I lost my train of thought there for a moment. Oh, yes, I wanted you to touch on... the Juan Williams firing from NPR, and
sure,
and what your thoughts are on that?
Sure, I don't have a lot about that in the book, in part because I'm not sure it really fit my notion of race baiting. But I have written before about what happened to Juan, and I have interviewed Juan, and he appears in the book when I talk about how. Politics handles issues of race and class, and I talked to him a little bit about Pat Buchanan, who was let go from MSNBC, over how he talks about race in his books. And I feel like what happened to Juan was NPR was in a situation where they were increasingly uncomfortable with how Juan was conducting himself when he wasn't on NPR. And they had already kind of reduced his role at NPR, substantially from when he had first started working there. And I think one of the big problems is that they had never really fully agreed on what the ground rules were for him when he was on Fox News. And I think they were also hamstrung by the fact that he was their most visible African-American on-air personality. And frankly, I think NPR made a mistake in not developing a more diverse array of on-air talent, so that when they felt the need to discipline Juan Williams, it didn't look like they were stifling the only African American male or the most prominent African American male on their air. That would have at least shown the world that there wasn't so much a racial component to this, as much as there was, I think, a failure to manage Juan and his outside appearances very well.
Do you think that NPR was uncomfortable of having Juan Williams appearing on the very conservative Fox News? And once this Muslim profiling business, alleged profiling, started, it was kind of an excuse to pull the trigger. Cokie Roberts has been on ABC for years and years.
Yeah, but when Cokie Roberts appears on ABC, which is a network, she appears on This Week, a network TV news show, the opinions that they express there are not as aggressive. They're not as, it's hard to find a word, but as in your face, I guess, as the, on cable TV news, the whole idea is to present provocative opinions that get people talking, that get people kind of stirred up. On a Sunday morning network TV talk show, that's not the mission. And Cokie Roberts doesn't express those kinds of views. And so I think what really happened was that Juan was in a situation where he was on cable TV news in prime time, and he was offering the kind of provocative opinions that are expected of the stars who operate in that genre. But NPR is not comfortable with that level of opinionating. And I also think they had never quite clearly established those ground rules. At least they hadn't established them internally. They didn't seem to have a way to say, okay, we sat down with Juan and we told him this is what we expected from him, and he violated this and this rule and this rule, and so now we're letting him go. I mean, one of the things I found kind of interesting was that his contract, I think, was going to be up in a few months anyway, and I'm surprised that they didn't just, express their disagreement with whatever opinion he offered, and then just let him write out the contract, and then just say, this isn't working for us. We feel like we're not comfortable with what you're doing outside of our channel, and let's just agree to disagree and kind of part ways. But instead, they had this situation where they let him go, and kind of did it in a way that was that wasn't very sensitive, so it wasn't handled in the most diplomatic way, is what I would say. But again, to me, the main problem is more the provocative nature of opinions that cable TV news personalities are expected to express on a regular basis. Mm-hmm.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, that's 1-800-743-9576.
And I should also point out that I also regularly work with NPR. I do commentaries on TV 3 to 4 times a month for the outlet. So, judge that as you will. I work a lot with NPR.
Again, our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Email, that's radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Eric, in the book, you distinguish between direct race baiting and also implicit terminology. Tell us more about that and how almost all of the cable channels, they want to reinforce the held beliefs of their viewers.
Right. Well, when I talk about implicit messaging versus explicit messaging, the idea is that implicit messages are messages that you're not meant to think consciously about, directly about, deliberately about. They're supposed to be things that kind of lurk in the back of your mind, but influence your ideas and your values and your decisions. So I quote a professor who wrote a book that talks a little bit about the Willie Horton ad that that was used to advocate for the election of George H.W. Bush when he was running against Michael Dukakis for the presidency. And that ad talked about a sort of scary-looking black murderer who was let out on a furlough program that was supported by Dukakis. And he escaped from that furlough program and went on to kill someone. And that was used as to say, you know, Michael Dukakis is soft on crime. But the way they presented this person, this Willie Horton, played to a lot of stereotypes about black people and about black criminality. And in fact, from what I understand, he didn't go by the name Willie. That was something that was coined for him in the ad. And they tried to play up his scary nature in presenting him in this ad. And the point isn't to say directly to the viewer, you should be scared of this politician who lets scary black people into your neighborhood. The point was to have you think that in the back of your mind, to have that be an assertion that sort of lurks in the corners of your consciousness so that you have this uneasy feeling. We saw it, we've seen it with President Obama, where we have these people who say they don't trust Obama. And then when you ask, well, why don't you trust him? What specific thing makes you not trust him? They say, oh, I just have a bad feeling about him. I just have this weird feeling about him. Now, is that people who are afraid that their opposition to Obama will be seen as racism? That's possible. But what I think is more likely is that they're uncomfortable with his race and yet have not dealt with that out in the open. So part of the book, part of the book's mission is to take these implicit messages that sometimes lurk in the back of our brains that politicians sometimes play on, and now media outlets have started to use the same techniques. My goal in the book is to take those implicit messages and drag them into the light, make people think about them consciously, deliberately, in the front of their mind. And, you know, one of the great successes of the civil rights movement, especially now that we're in the time of the week of Martin Luther King's birthday and we're coming up on Black History Month, is that civil rights activists have been able to convince the world, and the U.S. especially, that open prejudice against people of color is wrong. So if you're able to take these messages and make people think about them in the front of their brain, they realize it's wrong, and they will reject it. And that's the mission.
Explain the term that you use, dog whistle. It's kind of an interesting thought.
Well, it's the same idea. So this term was used a lot to refer to politics, particularly during the Republican primary, because Newt Gingrich in particular was adept at saying things that could be construed as playing on prejudices. One of the things that he did, for example, was that he would call President Obama the food stamp president. Because according to his figures, during Obama's administration, more people went on food stamps than any time in history. Now, we also know from study, I quote a book called Why Americans Hate Welfare by a professor at Princeton University. We know that Americans don't like the idea of welfare. If you talk to Americans about components of public aid programs for the poor, and you describe specific things, they go, oh, that sounds like a good idea. But when you mention the word welfare, that's associated with giving free things to people who don't do anything to earn them, particularly people of color, right? And so when Newt Gingrich talks about the food stamp president or makes references to, he said once, I don't care how many three-point jump shots President Obama makes, that's not going to make up for the fact that his policies are off base or something like that. Now, we know the president plays a lot of basketball, but we also know that this is a black president and people associate black people with basketball. And that seemed like a really disrespectful way to lump all of these ideas together, right? So in terms of the food stamp president line, again, that's a way of sort of reminding people of something that conservative radio outlets and media outlets have said more directly. This fear among some white people that this black president is mainly looking for ways to give free things to black people so they'll vote for him. Right. So and what was interesting was that I talked to a reporter for Slate magazine who was covering the campaign, and when Newt Gingrich won South Carolina, he asked a lot of voters there about this idea that Newt Gingrich was kind of referencing the idea of Obama advocating welfare and wanting to give free things to black people and all that sort of thing, and they agreed with it. They thought that was the message. They agreed with it, and they voted for Newt Gingrich for that reason. So it's not beyond the pale to think that these messages might work on people, and that you might even call it to their attention, and they might say, you know, yeah, I agree with that.
We're speaking with Tampa Bay Times reporter and media critic Eric Deggans about his book called Race Baiter. It's time for another short break. We'll be back in a moment. And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We're with Eric Deggans, and his book is Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. And once again, he'll be at Books and Books, the independent bookseller in Coral Gables at 8 p.m. That's tonight on Aragon Avenue. And we'll take a call or two. Got Tim. He's in Delray Beach. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I would like to know the author's opinions on Muslims and Islam in our news media, especially post 9/11, and some of the terms that have come about that are used in reference to the Muslim community.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I wrote this book long before Al Jazeera bought the English version of the Qatar-based news channel before they bought Current TV. And they have put this issue of how Muslims and the Arab world is treated in American media, they put it on the table, in the center of the table with this purchase. And I do think sometimes that has been an unfortunate element of news coverage that it, you know, particularly, now I do talk in the book a little bit about MSNBC in its early days, just after 9/11, when it was actually struggling with morphing into a watered down version of Fox News in a way. They had hired Jerome Scarborough, they had hired Michael Savage, and they had let go Phil Donahue Phil, if you asked Phil Donahue and some of the people who worked on his show, they felt he had been let go because he was too ardent a critic of the war, the drive towards war in Iraq, and felt like it wasn't justified. And so obviously, particularly after 9/11, I think the American news media had a real hard time being fair to the Arab world and being fair to Al Jazeera. I don't think there's any doubt that Al Jazeera, particularly the version that airs overseas, has aired some troubling things when it comes to talking about Jewish people and when it comes to talking about issues that might be more controversial in the Arab world. But I also think that if you were to look at some of the more extreme things that are said in Fox News, that some of the more extreme things that are said in American media in general, you know, you could find some things that might upset, you know, people who are from the Arab world that we've aired on our air. So I hope that the cable systems across the country will give this Al Jazeera version that airs where Current TV used to be, that they'll give it a chance, because they've won a lot of important awards, including important journalism awards in America for their coverage, and they've given us an insight into the Arab Spring and particularly what was happening in Egypt that we didn't that American news outlets had a hard time getting to, and I just think it's important to have a channel whose perspective might be rooted in something other than America, to give us a sense of how we're viewed in the world and how some of these issues that involve the Middle East are viewed in the world. So I would hope that in a democracy like America, we could make room for that perspective and learn from it.
And we'll move along to another caller. This is Dave in Miami. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask your guest how much he thinks that the demise of the fairness doctrine in broadcasting factors into the current situation with journalism today. I personally think that it's a debacle. I think anybody can go out and say anything and tell any sort of lie, no matter how enormous it is. But I just would like to know his views on this, and I'll take my call off the air. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for your call. The Fairness Doctrine, which I talk about in the chapter on talk radio, was an ideal that was maintained by the FCC. The idea being that if you were to present a political point of view, a particularly focused political point of view, that you would make an effort somewhere else in your broadcast day to offer an opposing viewpoint, a balancing viewpoint. It didn't have to be in the same show, but it would have to be sometime in the broadcast day. Now, I will say that I am not a proponent of bringing back the Fairness Doctrine. I don't think the government should be in the business of judging whether a media content is news or not, and judging whether or not media content is politicized or not, and whether it's left-wing or right-wing or centrist or whatever. I don't. In order to enforce the Fairness Doctrine, the government would have to make decisions about media content that I don't think it should be making. So I don't agree with the Fairness Doctrine. And I think what made the current climate much more possible, particularly in radio, was the consolidation of the industry and the fact that the Telecommunications Act of 1996 struck down all these barriers to owning large clusters of radio stations in a given community. In my own area, the Tampa Bay area, we have three major companies control something like 12 or 14 radio stations, most of them the top listened to stations in the market. And that was allowed by the Telecommunications Act. And so once that happened, these companies were allowed to focus on money-making styles of programming and let other kinds wither. So because Rush Limbaugh was popular, because that style of programming made a lot of money in the 80s, all of a sudden these companies focused on that style of programming to the exclusion of others, and now we have a talk radio scene that is dominated by these sort of strident, politically conservative voices with very little diversity within a broadcast day.
Tell me, Eric Deggans, about some of the cable news channels seem to just want to hire their pundits for their name value, such as even the disgraced Elliot Spitzer.
Well, you know, Elliot Spitzer is an interesting. You know, there's a few different things I think that kind of go into a hire in cable TV news. CNN, who hired Elliot Spitzer to host an 8 p.m. show a few years ago, CNN is in a curious position. Viewers flock to them when there's a news story where they want incisive reporting, particularly if it's a news story that's overseas, right? So when we saw unrest in Egypt, when we saw fighting in Libya, the inauguration, you know, they always have great numbers. But people don't tend to watch CNN when there's not breaking news, which is most of the time, right? So CNN's struggle is to attract an audience when there's no overarching calamitous breaking news. And so I think with Elliot Spitzer, they were just trying to do something different. They were trying to hire somebody who might make might earn them some headlines. You know, it was kind of controversial to hire a guy who had to resign the governorship in a prostitution scandal to be your lead anchor at 8 p.m.
Eric, we're gonna have to go because I want to once again tell our audience that you'll be appearing tonight at Books and Books at 8 o'clock in Coral Gables.
Eric, as you can tell, I like to talk, so come on out. We're going to talk about all the themes in this book in much more depth.
Eric Deggans is the author of Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. He joins us from St. Petersburg, and he's the media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. Thank you very much, Eric. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's today's edition. Apologies to those we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical director from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Tomorrow's program begins with psychologist Dr. Janice Webb. She writes about an invisible factor from childhood which weighs upon people as adults. And more, of course, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining with Fred Tasker. It's all about the blends of Bordeaux wines. And remember, we have free audio archives of past programs at our website, WLRN.org. There's also a Topical Currents Facebook page. And now our quality television calendar for January 23rd. On this day in 1975, 38 years ago, the premiere of cop comedy Barney Miller at the 12th Precinct on ABC. Fish, Dietrich, Wojo, and of course, Deplorable Coffee. And on this day in 1977, 36 years ago, the first episode of Alex Haley's miniseries Roots is aired to critical acclaim, again on ABC. And one more while we continue to master our domain. On this day in 1991, 22 years ago, the debut of the first full season of Seinfeld on NBC. Yada, yada, yada. So we leave with a thought from Jerry Seinfeld, who is an amateur wrestler, called himself the Jewish Terror. Quote, according to most studies, people's number one fear is public speaking. Number two is death. Death is number two. This means to the average person, if you go to a funeral, you're better off in the casket than doing the eulogy. Our theme music created by Michael Levine. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.